Welcome to the latest episode of Global Class, a podcast where we explore the international expansion stories of the world's fastest growing companies and the career journeys of their globally minded leaders. My name is Aaron McDaniel, and I'm here with my co-host, Klaus Wiehe.
Thanks, Aaron, and welcome to our listeners. In this episode, we're excited to welcome Marcelo Schermer, Head of International Expansion at Yoko, a South African-based fintech startup helping SMEs accept payments and get data-driven insights. Prior, Marcelo was Managing Director of SeedStars and a strategy consultant at Datacon Inc. In our conversation, Marcelo talks about the importance of immersing yourself in a new market to understand how trust is built, why it's crucial to build cross-cultural teams, as well as the growing opportunities across the continent of Africa with its fast-growing population and how Africa should be thought of as a source of innovation and not just as an opportunity for market entry. We look forward to today's conversation and share the insights with you at Global Class.
All right, Marcelo, thank you so much for joining us today. We're excited to talk about a number of things, about you and your journey, about Yoko, about some of the insights that you've been a big proponent of socializing around opportunities throughout the continent of Africa. Maybe we can start with you and your journey. We use this term in our book and in the podcast called being an intrapreneur, someone who is a globally minded business leader who has the cultural consciousness and the empathy to understand how to localize businesses for different markets. And your career from education and otherwise has taken you to multiple continents from Europe to South Africa and beyond. We'd love to just hear a little bit of background on your story and how you got to where you're at today.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me and really cool to be part of this. Yeah, my story is a bit different. So I grew up in Austria, but even there, my mother is Italian, my dad is Austrian. So kind of from early on, I started growing up in a very multicultural household where at home, it kind of felt like we were Italian. I'm at school and outside, it felt like we were Austrian. So from very early on, I started kind of bridging cultural gaps. I had to bridge cultural gaps quite naturally. Then, you know, also when I went to university and I studied, I decided to do a bit of a double major and I did business and psychology. So even there, kind of started bridging gaps a little bit, which was a lot of fun. And then when I left, I spent a few years working in the US and then moved to South Africa about 6 years ago and been working there ever since. My life has been a lot of multicultural, cross-cultural work and insight. And so that's prepared me, I think, for, you know, the work in international expansion and taking companies into different markets.
So Marcelo, I've been particularly excited to have you on the podcast. I find it to be very interesting that someone like you just travels to Africa in around 2013, kind of seeing the opportunities that exist in the market. And not really a lot of people have do that, you know, going through Africa, uprooting yourself from, you know, Austria in Europe, and then going in and then being this big proponent in developing the entrepreneurial ecosystem in the region. What was the thing that triggered you to take that step? What was the moment or, you know, the article or whatever it is that you actually read or saw that sort of pushed you to go on that journey?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So the moment where it all started for me was back in 2013, actually my first trip on the continent. I came to join an event that a friend of mine had organized called Startup Bus. And basically the friend of mine had this crazy idea. Let's take a bus, drive from Harare in Zimbabwe all the way to Cape Town in South Africa and do like a bit of a hackathon along the way and stop at a couple of, you know, co-working spaces, hubs, meet local startups, meet local entrepreneurs. And what was really interesting, the composition of the group on that bus was, you know, have people from outside of the continent, have people from different parts of the continent, but also then we stopped along the way on different hubs and incubators and met different startups. And, you know, and not having had a particularly great knowledge about Africa or the tech space on the continent before that, what I saw really blew me away. We stopped at, you know, incubators and co-working spaces in random places where people were working on, you know, the most interesting startups and technologies and ideas. The people on the bus were all incredible entrepreneurs and people who, you know, kind of showed me a lot of the potential on the market. And that's kind of where the initial click happened for me, right? You come to this place, you have very little context, very little pre-information, and you start getting exposed to really, really interesting people, really interesting spaces, really interesting environments. And you start seeing, wow, you know, this is kind of, there's something here. And that's really the kind of event that triggered my interest and my passion in the continent. And then, you know, from there, I started looking for different ways to get involved and support and be part of that journey of startup growth on the continent. And then it all started in kind of 2015 when I, you know, moved to the continent then full time to be part of the ecosystem here. But the trigger event that really sparked my curiosity for and my interest for tech on the continent was really that crazy bus ride we did in 2013.
That's so cool. We often hear when we speak to entrepreneurs like you about these formative experiences that you have. And so I think in particular, that combination of how you grew up multiculturally at home and an elaborate bus ride is really, really cool. So you have this great TEDx talk where you talk about witnessing the African startup revolution. And there's this awesome quote you have, entrepreneurs are building global businesses, solving local problems that the rest of the world didn't even know existed. I'm curious if you can build on that a bit. It's such a cool thought, and I know there's many layers below it.
Yeah, so I think it comes from, and maybe I need to tell a bit of a background story, is that, you know, when generally speaking, when we think about, you know, the continent, there's this preconception that the quote-unquote Western world is more advanced than the quote-unquote developing world, and people often have this expectation that development is something linear, right? Like that there's this concept of whatever, like America is, I don't know, 10 years ahead of Europe, and so what's happening in America today is going to happen in Europe 10 years from now. And Africa is whatever, how many years back. And we often think that development is this like a linear thing, right? And that there's a country or civilization or society that's like at the forefront and everybody else is just going to develop the exact same way. And it's just a matter of time. And I think that's often the preconception of, I guess, global development we have in particular in the Western world. And that, you know, I probably had to growing up. But what I started seeing is that it's actually not like that, right? Development is not a linear thing. Like this, countries develop on different paths at different speeds and in different ways. And what I started finding really, really fascinating is if you look at the continent, how, you know, a lot of businesses on the continent started solving really, really interesting problems in really, really interesting ways that people in other parts of the world don't even know exist. You know, we often talk about things like mobile money, for example, which is quite an obvious one, where you have telcos that already have access to the majority of the population. Why don't they also go into, you know, giving them financial services and banking, which is a concept that, you know, we don't have in Europe, we don't have in the US. If you want money stuff, you go to a bank. If you want telco stuff, you go to a telco. That doesn't exist. And in so many other industries, you see examples like this, where local entrepreneurs or local companies are actually solving really, really interesting problems or creating really, really interesting opportunities that we didn't know, even know existed in the quote-unquote Western world. And I think that's just such an important insight because it changes that dynamic or changes that stereotype of Africa having to catch up to the Western world. And I think it frames it much more nicely as, you know, Africa is on its own path of development and its own path of growth. And it might not look like the US or Europe or China or whoever. And that's, I think, a really important one. And the second thing I would say is that what we also often don't realize is how in the quote-unquote Western world, both population-wise and soon also economic-wise, we're actually the minority. I don't remember the stats from the top of my head, but way more than 50% of the population today lives in emerging markets. And soon more than 50% of world GDP is going to come from emerging markets. And so if you're building something in Uganda or in Nigeria or in Bangladesh, chances are there's more people in the world and more places in the world that are similar to where you're starting to build something than if you're building something in New York or in Silicon Valley. And soon the economic power dynamic is also going to shift where there's going to be more purchasing power and more economic power in emerging markets than in quote-unquote developed markets. And so I think I feel very strongly about the fact that entrepreneurs who start in emerging markets actually have a really interesting opportunity to grow and scale into other emerging markets who then happen to make up the majority of the world, increasingly so. And that's, I think, a really, really interesting opportunity for the future that I think especially in Western countries we're not particularly aware of, and people still believe that, you know, they kind of quote unquote own the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really when you understand where the growth is happening, it really reframes how you think about things. The other interesting thought is how innovation is happening from a company perspective. So kind of to take a Silicon Valley viewpoint, you have all of these companies like the Googles and Facebooks and others of the world that were attempting to take one core product and basically expand and swallow up these other existing industries where there's infrastructure and other things. You know, everything from like Google launching balloons for the internet and stuff. But then you look at it, emerging markets like Africa and some of these things that are being set up, like you mentioned in banking, that just never existed at all. And so it's like, this is the first time a company is even bringing that solution to market. It's just a really cool thought of establishing the foundation instead of a behemoth company attempting to just gobble up everything that's already set up. That's yeah, it's interesting. You've been alluding to this too, but you know, any comments just to make sure people truly understand the market of Africa? Like in your TEDx talk, I mean, just talking about how a majority of a population of over a billion is under the age of 19, and how this is not, you know, I know there's a lot of references to the whole continent, but there are over 50 countries that are very, very different. You know, would love just some thoughts there so people listening can truly understand.
Yeah, for sure. I think the first thing here, and you mentioned this, is the first misconception about the continent is people often think it's one market or one country, when in reality, you're looking at 54 different countries that also economically and socioeconomically are at very different stages. As a whole, you're looking at a region that has over a billion people, by far the youngest average population, like you mentioned. I think over 50% is below 20 years old. But also economically, I think what's really interesting is that out of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world, I think over 50% are economies on the continent, multiple markets that are growing GDP double digits per year, which is unheard of in any other part of the world. The other thing that I think people don't often underestimate is how big African cities are. So if you're looking at cities, there was a study that came out a while back. I think by 2030, there will be, I think it's between 10 or 15 cities on the continent that have more than 10 or 15 million people. And those are like massive concentrations of people, right? Even today, you have cities like Lagos with 20 million people. You have cities like Cairo with somewhere between 10 and 15 million people. You take Johannesburg and Pretoria together, and that's another 10 million people. You take Kinshasa, Dar es Salaam, you know, cities like that, they're soon going to be over 10 million people. And so you have a massive number of cities that are becoming huge by themselves, which again, it's massive opportunity from an economic perspective. So the tricky thing about the continent is that it's big, there's opportunity, a lot is growing, but it's also very fragmented and, you know, also very, very different. A country in West Africa works very different to a country in East Africa. North Africa and Southern Africa have huge differences. So if you can embrace the fragmentation, the opportunity of growth on the continent is absolutely huge, but it is very, very fragmented.
You mentioned a bit before that people often lump the African countries together into obviously just one market. I would love to maybe to dig a bit more deeper into that in describing those differences maybe between two different markets that really put a stark contrast to that. Can you share a bit more about how different it can be, whether it's cultural, whether it's like market context-wise, whatever that is? I think the listeners would really benefit to really understand those differences.
So you're saying contrast to specific markets?
Probably the easiest, yeah, instead of you have, you know, again, to the point of not lumping things together. Yeah, okay.
Maybe an interesting way of comparing this is taking a country like Ethiopia and comparing it to a country like, let's say, South Africa, for the sake of the argument. Ethiopia is about 110 million people. South Africa is about 60 million people, but that's kind of where the similarity stops, right? So Ethiopia is much more culturally different. So I think Ethiopia has about 90 different tribes. South Africa has about 11 or so. But in Ethiopia, a lot of the economic power, for example, is concentrated in the capital, in Addis Ababa, and the rest is relatively agricultural, where South Africa has multiple economic centers. If you look at languages, you know, South Africa has about 11 official languages. Ethiopia actually don't even know. They have a lot of tribal languages, but then there's a common language, which is Amharic. And economically, they're completely different places as well, right? So the markets are very, very, very different. And I think you can kind of play that example with almost like any set of markets on the continent, right? If you go to compare Nigeria and Egypt, two completely different places. So I think no market is like the other. You know, generally, there's some similarity with proximity, but still, as soon as you cross a border, and even within countries, you have lots of different cultures and tribes and regions and languages that even within the same country can make a big difference.
It's cool. And speaking about that fragmentation of markets, as you say, and you as someone that leads international expansion for Yoko, how do you deal with those things? How do you tackle the fragmentation when you expand a country from obviously an initial market to new markets in the African region? Can you share a bit more about that?
Yeah. So I think there's only two ways of really doing this. either you're lucky enough to be in an industry where you don't have to necessarily care too much about that fragmentation because you're selling something that's so universal that it doesn't really make a difference. Let's say you're Coca-Cola, right? Doesn't really matter if people speak different languages or different cultures or different religions. People like having their Coke, so it's fine. So either you're lucky enough to be in an industry where you don't have to adapt too much, or the only other way is embrace that fragmentation and make it almost like a key part of your business and expansion strategy, where you know that every time you get into a new market, your product, your service, your offering needs to evolve to a certain extent and needs to be adapted to the local market to a certain extent. And I think building your business, your product, your strategy, your team in a way that it can accommodate for these localizations and accommodate for having to localize in each market, I think that's really the winning strategy for internationalizing, in particular on the continent.
Yeah, that's interesting. We actually were having a conversation yesterday with Jerry Engel, who's a former faculty in a number of places, but used to lead the entrepreneurship program at Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. And he was reminding us how this notion of national borders is kind of a more only a thing in recent history. You know, beyond, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, it was much more fragmented and, you know, even within countries. So just to,
and also one thing to add here is maybe to add on this point, what's even more on the continent is that in many places, national borders are an even more recent introduction and a very arbitrary thing as well, right? A lot of borders in the continent, and unfortunately have been drawn by former colonialist countries. And they often put borders through areas with the same language, through areas with the same culture. And so even more so on the continent, the whole concept of borders is actually, many borders are very new and a lot of them are kind of externally introduced and introduced relatively arbitrarily, which makes the whole concept of borders on the continent even more tricky.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. So we'd love to talk a little bit about Yoko as a company, but maybe as a transition point, as you were touching on before, for in a lot of these emerging markets, the innovation path is not always linear. And so would love to talk a little bit about fintech. You know, I always think about, started my career at AT&T, so I always think about networks and how, you know, there's not the same wired network throughout Africa as there is in the US and Europe, but then the leapfrogging to more advanced mobile solutions, right, as the foundation. But would love to hear that in the context of fintech and how a lot of that scaffolding is being built now and using more advanced principles and not having to transition from an existing solution. So would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, I guess, where the concept of leapfrogging comes in, which is often used in the context of, I guess, technology development on the continent. I think as a whole, when it comes to fintech, maybe you just paint a picture. We spoke about over a billion people. But financial inclusion on the continent as an average is really, really low. I think less than 25% of people on the continent have a bank account, or if not even less, or some kind of formal institutional account. And that's a problem because it excludes people from a lot of financial activities that we take for granted in many other parts of the world. If you don't have a financial record, you cannot take out a loan to buy a house. If you don't have a financial record, you cannot, you know, get out a loan to do something else. You cannot take insurance. You're not building up a credit score. You're almost inexistent as a participant in the economic environment. Building those foundations of financial inclusion, which is giving people places to store their money digitally, giving people ways to spend and save money digitally, giving people ways to leverage, get credit, get insurance, and kind of participate in the financial industry is absolutely crucial to the development of the continent. And so that's why fintech is so important right now, because it's companies trying to build these rails to give people their first kind of digital account, digital access to the financial industry. And that's, I think, why we're hearing so much about fintech and why fintech is so important, because it's really building those foundational rails. That is then what you need to build anything else on top, right? You're not going to have a streaming service if people cannot pay you digitally. You're not going to have online health or online schooling or education platform if people cannot pay online. And so there's a big push towards fintech on the continent today, because it's really the main barrier to unlocking a lot of other things. And I think that's why it's so exciting and so hot right now.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up financial inclusion, because that is a big issue in the United States, but it's also at a, from a very different perspective, right? That's really, really interesting. We have found that in our research, how important the notion of payments is to different markets and how different it can be. And if you don't get it right as you're expanding to new markets, that can be a problem for companies that are expanding. Can you give us a little insights into what payments look like across different countries in Africa and maybe how diverse it is and how much is cash relied on? Are there cultural elements to payments that have to do with trust building or anything? We'd love to understand that better.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. So I think as a starting point, cash is king on the continent. It's hard to get reliable numbers on this, but people say over 95%, if not more, of all payments on the continent today still happen in cash. So I think that's a starting point. Now you're seeing a lot of push towards digital payments, and it's usually there's probably two or three different avenues where that's coming from. So one is, of course, your traditional banks that, give people accounts and give people cards and all sorts of other things. The tricky thing there is like they've traditionally focused on a very small portion of the market due to their fees and the way they conduct business. And so they kind of cover one slice of that equation. The other slice that you see on the continent is telco-led financial services. So like the mobile money example I pointed out earlier. What's interesting there is that they're basically building telco-led closed-loop wallets. So you have four telcos in the market. All four telcos offer their own mobile money solution. But what happens is that as opposed to cards, they're often not interoperable. So if I have a MTN mobile money account and you have an Airtel mobile money account, in many markets, there's no way of moving money between these, which then leads people to having multiple SIM cards and doing a lot of these kind of things to be able to pay. That's changing. Lots of countries are introducing interoperable mobile money systems now, which is a big step in the right direction. And then the third kind of change we're seeing to drive financial inclusion is through, neobanks in the grand scheme of things. So we're seeing, kind of challenger bank style companies pop up in many countries on the continent who are also trying to bring more people into the fold. We're still at the early stages of all of this, but I think they're very much driving that development. The other thing to your question around cultural nuances, what I think is really interesting is that cash is very trusted because cash, the transfer of value happens immediately. If I give you $100, you have it in your hand right away. There's no fees associated with cash, at least no obvious fees, right? If I give you $100, you have $100. And the cost of cash other than that isn't generally factored into people's equations, right? Even though they have to go to a bank and wait in line and cash it in or whatever it might be, or the safety risk is often not factored in. And so the prevailing assumption is that cash is cheaper than digital payments. But also what's making the transition away from cash so tricky is that in most cases, the entire value chain is cash-based. So take the example of a restaurant, for example, right? When their supplier comes and drops food for the day, in most countries on the continent, they expect to be paid in cash and immediately. Whereas in many other parts of the world, a restaurant would have a payment terms with their supplier. Maybe they would pay at the end of the month. They would have a 90-day payment period. And so there's a lot more room to manage cash flow. Whereas in many parts of the continent, when the supplier comes to the restaurant, they want cash immediately. So that creates a problem because now if, let's say, the restaurant accepts card payments only clear into your account 2 days after the payment has happened, then you still need to go to the bank, withdraw cash, take the cash to your restaurant and pay the supplier. And in that whole transaction, you're losing between 1.5% and 3% of the value because that's what the bank charges you. That's actually a really bad value proposition when the alternative is that you just take cash from the customer. When the supplier comes, you give him or her cash and everything runs smoothly. What you see in many parts of the continent is that the digitization and digitization of payments actually needs to cover the entire value chain. Because if you only take out individual parts of the value chain, you're actually breaking a system that's working surprisingly well for most people. And so, yeah, I think that's also, I guess, a cultural or habitual nuance that's making it much, much trickier, especially on the B2B side to drive digital payments.
So we definitely want to dig more into the digitization part of what you're talking about and how Yoko fits into that. But What one interesting comment that reminds me of a few things that we heard as we were doing our research and talking to business leaders is how, you know, companies often, when they're looking to enter a new market, in particular emerging market, when they think of market entry, really what they're thinking about is not the greater population, but sort of this more internationally minded subsegment that tends to be richer, that doesn't necessarily have the same, you know, the problem framing value proposition is very different to a majority of the population. And it's just an interesting, it's an interesting thing when you view it that way to truly understand that you know, what you might think of as the first group that would pay for your product in part because they trust things like digital payment and otherwise is very different than a majority of the markets in a lot of emerging countries.
Yeah, for sure. That's a really good point. I think that the challenge there, of course, is how big is that segment? Depending on the market, that segment might be big enough to build a business or not. And two, I guess the other question there is then how fast is that segment growing? How can you then expand from that early adopter segment into the majority? But definitely makes perfect sense to start your business in a market or a segment that is more responsive to whatever it is that you're offering. And I think that makes a lot of business sense to focus on your early adopters before going mass market.
I want to double down a bit on this topic of international expansion, right? And one of the big things that we found in our research is that companies often reinvent the wheel. There's not been any frameworks out there that people can go in and adopt, or not any book that they can go and find and read to really build up this knowledge and muscle, I guess. And hence, obviously, Global Class is being written right now and coming on the market in August. Sorry, guys, to promote it right there. But I guess one of my big questions is, how are you, or what are you doing to prepare the organization for expansion? And maybe I'll throw something in here maybe to lead you a bit in a certain way, because you actually had an interesting comment to me on our last call. You said, pick a small market, an easy market, and localize the product. And kind of that is a bit different from what other organizations, other companies are doing. For example, Danish companies tend to go directly to the US, where, you know, Zendesk as an example, their sort of initial market, or at least the first market they built the product in, was Denmark. And then they actually scaled up in the US to pick that market as the first market to scale in. There's a bit of a contrast there. You say picking a small market, building up the muscle versus, you know, maybe a Danish company that goes to the US and they want to build a business there.
Yeah, that's a very interesting one. So I think the biggest thing here is it depends a lot on the business and how easy it is to scale, right? So to make an extreme example, it's much easier to scale an online platform that doesn't really need much localization to a market, and you can just kind of grow even remotely. Like, it's much easier to scale that than it is to grow, say, a company like Yoko, which is a fintech company, locally regulated in each market we enter, with physical footprint, logistics operations, right? Like the effort required to localize in these two instances is very, very different. So kind of my comment to you came very much from that place of businesses that are very complex to expand. And kind of, yeah, the way we think about it is probably like three big pillars when it comes to expanding a company for us, right? One is make your product and platform ready for expansion. Two is make your culture and team ready for expansion. And then three is almost like build a structure that's going to support that expansion into a new market for you. You know, we've taken an approach where some of these things we've experimented with in smaller markets, where we did some of the hard work on a small scale, because the assumption was that, you know, you don't want to make basic mistakes in big markets where a lot is at stake. So almost like use leverage pilots and tests in smaller markets to build a bit of an experience, build a bit of a playbook, so that when you then go into bigger markets, you kind of operating much faster and at a better scale. That's an approach that worked well for us, but of course can be very different for other companies. And I think it's heavily dependent on the product that you're trying to expand.
I think that's really, really cool. You actually talk a lot about the three effective pillars of growth that we have in the book. And I see Aaron smiling as well on the call. But there's one piece that maybe you didn't speak too much about, more from the management side, right? So when you expand into a new market, you know, you might face a bit of difficulties in management and managing that market when you scale globally. What are some of the things that you do to empower the team and granting autonomy and trust to those teams for them to be, you know, effective at localizing the business? Because obviously, you know, the further away from the market that, you know, I guess this, the dumber the decisions can really be if you don't really put that trust in the local team to kind of bring that feedback of local market insights to the mothership of the business, if you will.
Yeah. So I'm a big believer expansion being very much driven by the local team. You know, again, that might be more true in for a company like ours and might be less important for other companies. But in our case, I'm a very, very big believer in the importance of expansion and localization being led by the markets you're expanding into. And then I think what you basically need to do is from a structure perspective, you need to build a structure that supports that, right? So you want the team at HQ to overly simplify it. You almost want them to act as a service provider or like a platform builder to the local team, and the local team needs to drive a lot of those demands and requests and strategies. And then it's the responsibility of HQ to support and enable those strategies to happen rather than HQ making decisions for what are we going to do. And so I think from a structure and team perspective, you need to build up your HQ team so that they see themselves in this role. And then you need to make sure you really invest in strong senior talent early on the ground so that they can drive a lot of the growth and take the company on that journey of expansion. So I think that's really how I think about it. And I think that's probably how you get to build really, really meaningful localized businesses that can still act relatively independently and effectively.
That's great. If we were playing international bingo right now, I think I'd have a full card with a number of things you talked about. And I think speaking on Klaus's behalf, we both love in particular how you highlighted this structure and process part, because it's not some magical thing where you're like, oh, I just, you know, people are going to be empowered and they're all, you know, without that structure, you're going to end up falling into a lot of these pitfalls that typically companies find themselves in when they have failed expansion operations. So I'd love to dig into that a little bit. Maybe one thing in particular that's a common thread through a lot of these structures that we've developed and think about is the concept of feedback loop and how, you know, you were starting to talk about it a little bit about this two-way communication, two-way innovation, things along those lines. Would love to get a few more thoughts of ideas you've had or things that have been implemented at Yoko that allow for those feedbacks to happen, but are formalized structures, either cultural practices and rituals, you know, that these are done in this way, or more specific team structures of people being built with certain focus.
Yeah, I think the important thing here is actually both. So from a team structure, you actually want to make sure that you build out the team that's cross-cultural and experienced across markets early enough, and not just in functions related to expansion, but actually pretty much across the team. I mean, of course, in your expansion team and in your expansion related functions, you need people who have experience and exposure to other markets. But I think making sure that early on your team is as cross-functional and as cross-cultural as possible is really important, because that's going to help a lot with doing that. I think that's one. Two, what's quite important to us is making sure that we share back a lot of information from markets with the team. We emphasize a lot of storytelling. We emphasize a lot of, you know, merchant examples. We often share interviews or insight with the team to get them closer to the market. And also in many instances, make sure we send people on the ground and actually spend time there, because that's usually the most powerful way of experiencing a market. And so I think, you know, if you're very intentional about making sure that you feedback information from these markets to the rest of the team, get people exposed to markets as much as possible, I think that's a really, really powerful way of getting that socialized. And then I think on the team structuring side, as you mentioned, especially in expansion-related functions, making sure that you have strong cross-functional teams where everybody is part of, and where everybody's part of the same team. Because the last thing you want is that you develop like an us versus them mentality, right? Like you don't want people in HQ to sit there and be like, ah, these guys in the other markets, what are they doing? You almost want them to be part of the same team. People play different roles, but essentially work towards the same goal. And so I think investing a lot into teaming and team forming and getting the teams aligned and working together is also really important, because then that kind of gets people to work on the same goal quite effectively.
Bingo again, right?
reading from your book.
I think that the share back concept, the storytelling, I think that's great. Maybe ask in a different way what you've been dancing around a bit. One thing that we found is in a lot of companies, we've heard this notion that international often doesn't have a home, team structure wise. Now, obviously, you're head of international expansion, a little bit different. You're given that focus. But one of your biggest roles is building buy-in and support, rallying the whole team around international, in particular at an executive level that goes cross-functional. functionally. Talk about maybe some best practices or things you found that have been effective in getting everyone on the same page, getting them to prioritize expansion and not just growth in existing market.
That's an excellent question. So I think, by no means would I say that I've got this figured out completely. But I think the important thing here is, I mean, on a foundational level, there needs to be a willingness in the company to expand internationally. If that's not there, then it's really hard to create that. So that needs to be there on a foundational level. What's important then is understanding what is the right time to expand. And that depends a lot on the company and the state of the market. And then when the time is right, then it's about showing the opportunity for growth in the different markets, right? And so showing how bigger can this company get? So how many more customers can we serve? How much is our product portable or relatable to other markets? And often doing that requires a lot of on the ground work. So I found one of the best ways of doing it is just bringing the senior team of the company onto market visits and just get them to spend a couple of time on the ground. And that's usually the most effective way of convincing people because they can see it for themselves. So that's a really, really, really important part. Yeah. And so basically what you're doing is, and the way I look at the expansion function at Yoko is often you're almost managing a funnel of market and you're managing different markets to different stages of the funnel. And the more advanced your markets are, the more important it becomes to get buy-in from the team. And that then kind of increasingly becomes easier the more you bring people into markets and get them exposed to the markets for themselves. So that's kind of how I think about getting buy-in. But I think the key thing is the company needs to be willing to expand internationally at some point, because otherwise probably nothing you can do.
Right. That's really, really cool. And it was kind of funny you dropped that comment that you didn't read off the book right now, because I was about to ask you that, because you, as Aaron alluded to, bingo, basically the full plate. You've literally gone through almost all the expansion failures, but actually how you've done it the right way, I guess, in the book. So it's kind of funny. Anywho, you alluded a bit to it here just now in terms of the importance of doing localization discovery. One thing is yourself, your team, etc., but also exposing the leadership team so they understand the context of that market, so you can easier socialize and get that buy-in to obviously invest time, resources for the expansion efforts when you expand. I guess, I'd be more curious to get a bit more insights in terms of how you did it when you brought over the executive team. For example, we spoke to Airbnb's team that led Asia expansion, where they brought the founder and CEO over to kind of look at how users were using the Airbnb app through a two-way mirror, I believe it's called, right? How did you do it? What stakeholders did you interact with? What were some of the aha moments? What were some of the comments from the leadership team that were like, aha, I really didn't think about it in this way? This really gave me some insight and understanding, and we need to do more. We need to invest more into expansion and bringing Yoko into the local market.
Yeah. When I work on an immersion like this, the immersion usually has about 2 to 3 different parts to it. So the first part is customer immersion. So depending on how much time we have, we'd spend a day or two just visiting potential customers. And that's a really, really crucial part of our work, because we actually spend time in the shops of small businesses. We actually spend time with users of digital payment methods, and really just kind of understand on very much a one-on-one basis, like what drives them, how do they think about it, how do they work? And that's the most important thing, to empathize with the market. The second important thing is getting exposure to potential partners in these markets. So really understanding like what would a route to entering might look like, who could we work with, who are the kind of key stakeholders in the environment. So we usually spend a lot of time also talking to them. And then the third is actually there's a lot of value in, and depending on how much time we have, sometimes we do this and sometimes we don't, but there's also just a lot of value in just very serendipitous market immersions, right? Walk through a street, drive down a highway. There's so much nuance you can get out of understanding what are the billboards that you see on a highway or on a street, how are shop, the windows, or how do storefronts work, or turning on the TV and be like, what are the ads in the meantime? Or even on the flight there, opening the in-flight magazine of the local airline and understanding like who is there and who's showing. So there's a lot of value you can get from very like serendipitous and normal activities on the ground. And so we kind of try and weave all of these things together into a couple days of market experience and market immersion. And then of course, try and like debrief and share insights on a regular basis to make sure the learnings are shared and vocalized. But a structure like that I found being very, very useful to get people an understanding of the market fairly fairly quickly and in a fairly broad way.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. There's this American management notion called leadership by walking around, like and by observing things happening in the company, you learn things. And you know, this is the market discovery equivalent. And you're not the first we've heard this from. It is so key to get out there and truly talk to everyday people, go in everyday situations to see how people live, because it gives you amazing context. You know, that customer immersion, the other key stakeholders, partners.
I'd love to actually get a bit more of an understanding of what are some of those experiences that you gave the leadership team just observing the market instead of just having a structured approach with immersion. As an example, you know, when I help sort of lead product launch strategy for Carlsberg in Vietnam, it was often just sitting down and just feeling the environment. You know, we were researching the beer market, consumption, etc., how people were interacting, just seeing, okay, how are they socializing with each other? We couldn't understand the conversation because I didn't know Vietnamese, but it was really just getting a sense of things. What were some of the things that you did to allow for those serendipitous moments, allow for that observation to happen? And were there any insights that came out of it?
There may be two examples that come to mind. I mean, one is, you know, because we are in the payment space, and in particular in the payment space for SMEs, a very powerful thing is to just kind of like spend some time sitting inside a small business. And even if you're not talking to the people, they're just observing, how do people pay? How do people work through the shops? How are the businesses serving them? How do businesses track their stock? All of these things. And so I think a lot of those observations have led to a lot of interesting insights about the market. The other one that I found very interesting, and I briefly touched on this before, is just kind of driving along the highway and seeing the billboard along the highway, because you start to understand how different markets create trust differently. For example, so there are some markets that where trust is generated very much on a kind of personal level. So ads would have famous people or influencers, and you have countries that are much more dependent on that kind of ad. And so you see billboards, and every billboard has the face of a famous soccer player, musician, or something. And that's how trust is created. Whereas in a lot of other markets, you know, the US and a lot of Europe is a good example of that. You don't really have that much. Trust is created much more with like facts and labels and stamps and those kind of things. And, you know, just kind of like driving on the car, and that can literally be between one meeting and the other, right? Like driving on the car, looking out of the window, seeing how ads are structured differently in different markets, that can also give you really, really interesting insights into how things work on the ground.
That's a really cool insight. I like that. That notion of trust is so core to just about any company, no matter what industry you're in, especially as you're coming from an outside market. That trust is almost step one. That's really cool.
And especially in payments, because you're dealing with people's money. It's one thing if you're a platform where people look for whatever, like dog food delivery service, but you also have to build trust there. But if I'm coming to you and I'm like, give me all the money you made today, and I promise you I'll give it to you tomorrow, that's a big ask to make of somebody who's never heard of you. And so understanding how trust is built in a market is super, super, super key, because people need to trust you with their money at the end of the day.
Absolutely. I guess going back to your previous comment in terms of the market and the region is very much cash-based. And so moving over to digital payments is very, very hard. And obviously trust becomes critical in order to kind of being able to push that, right? So
curious, when you look at that full list of potential stakeholders to talk to, I mean, we've heard everything from trade associations to government representatives to universities to investors. Is there a specific stakeholder that maybe a lot of people overlook that they don't think about talking to in understanding a local market that you found to be particularly important?
It's very, I mean, this might be very dependent on the industry you're in, but what's very, very valuable for me is talking to other startups, even if they're in different industries. And the reason why that is because entrepreneurs have a almost like natural sense to see opportunity. And so, you know, spending time with other entrepreneurs in new markets, independent of the industry, actually gives you a very good sense for what are the opportunities in the market? How do people feel about the way things are growing and moving? And it's also a great community of people to be part of, because, you know, people in the entrepreneurship space love to help each other, work together, partner with each other. And so for me, I always find it very, very fascinating to spend time with other entrepreneurs, even if they're in different industries, because there's always something interesting you can learn from people trying to solve other parts of the country's opportunity space, which is always super, super valuable.
That's really, really cool.
So we'd love to fix our eyes on the future for a moment. And I think one comment that you had previously made that I thought was just great that I'd love to get a little bit more background on it. You had said that we should think about how we can be more like Africa and not how to make Africa more like us in terms of other developing countries. And I think that that's a great mindset, in part because if we're attempting to say, oh, and this is what we do in developed markets and we need to push this into the continent of Africa, we're making the same mistakes that were made during colonialism. And so we'd just love to get some of your thoughts on that quote, because I think it's really cool.
Yeah, you've summarized it well, right? I think we often assume, and I think we spoke about this at the beginning as well, but like we often assume that development happens one way. And so technology transfer needs to happen one way, right? So whatever technology has been invented in the US today is just going to copy it and paste it into emerging markets or Africa in this case, when the reality is that this can actually go both ways. A lot of mobile money has now grown out of Africa into other markets, for example. A lot of distributed energy companies that started doing solar panels for rural communities on the continent and came up with really fascinating financing models for those are now expanding into other markets as well. And so I think a lot of the problems that are being faced on the continent are relatively global. And so, you know, I think the point here is that we can look at the continent as a source of innovation as much as we can look at the continent as an opportunity to grow into. I think that it needs to go both ways because there's so much to learn from each other in both directions.
That's really, really cool. I remember watching a presentation by you on TEDx where you shared three things that that other countries or the world can learn from Africa. Do you want to share those three key things that they can learn?
Are you putting me on the spot? The TEDx talk was like 4 years ago.
Maybe to change that question, what are some of the things you learned by being there over the past 9 years?
Yeah, I think for me, it's something about resourcefulness and being like very resourceful around tackling local problems. That's really been something that I've learned and still learning and I'm still getting exposed to. And it still kind of blows my mind every day. I think that kind of resourcefulness has been a really big inspiration for me. I think in terms of businesses specifically, There's an interesting company that I always look up to that I really enjoy. It's called Zipline. As much as it's based in the US, they kind of started on the continent with doing drone deliveries of blood and medical supplies to rural hospitals. And it's been really interesting. I think the first market was Rwanda, and they went into a couple of other markets, and they're now growing into more developed markets where they're offering that service as well, which I believe is a really, really interesting, really, really interesting export. There's another company that I've always appreciated a lot, which basically made like a tractor sharing model where, in kind of more large scale agriculture, cultural economies, your farmer tends to have a lot of all of the equipment he or she needs to do their work, whereas on the continent, that's often not the case. And so this company started this like almost Uber for tractor kind of model where, instead of owning the equipment yourself, you can kind of request it when you need it and therefore, dramatically cut down the cost of that, but also increasing your yields dramatically, which then again increases economic opportunity for people. So, there's stuff like that I think is really, really interesting and super applicable to a lot of parts of the world. But yeah, there's many examples.
I mean, this is why we're excited about doing this podcast. We really get these local insights and local nuances on how to build businesses on local problems, and the world can learn from these things as well. And I think what's really interesting about Zipline is that it's actually a Silicon Valley funded company, but their first market that they're scaling in is in Rwanda, I believe. So, and we actually spoke to Israel Bimbe, who was on our 9th episode. So for listeners out there, you should listen to that one because he also brings some good perspective on how they're scaling in Rwanda. And we spoke to, he's the director of Africa go-to-market, right? So it's really good and interesting to get those insights, Jim. How do you actually scale and expand in that region, right? So it was funny you called it out there. So I just wanted to throw it in there. I guess what does, this is a more like a bigger question. And I wanted to kind of get your thoughts thoughts on that as well. What does the future hold then for the region in Africa? We talked a lot about population growth. We talked a lot about leapfrogging of technology. Where does, you know, the region, where will that play in terms of the role of innovation in the future, in your view?
I think innovation is going to play such a big part in the growth of the continent. I mean, if you look at the development, it's just a metric, one of many metrics, but like if you look at the growth of startup funding since I started being active on the continent, it's quite mind-blowing. I think when I started, startup funding on the continent was probably a couple $100 million in a year. In here 2021, I think we're crossing $4 or $5 billion invested into startups on the continent for the first time, which is a massive, massive growth in the grand scheme of things. At the same time, you know, you compare that to hundreds of billions of dollars that went into European startups, for example, and it shows you that we're still very much at the beginning of the journey and the development. But yeah, if you're looking at the amount of companies that are coming up, if you're looking at the amount of investment that's going into them, if you're looking at the amount of people who are starting companies for the first time or going from corporate into startup, I'm super, super, super bullish on the role of innovation on the continent, especially the role of innovation built by local founders, local companies, local teams to really solve and tackle opportunities on the continent and in other parts of the world. I'm super, super bullish on that.
I think it's really, really cool. And it's exciting to see the attention that exists right now on entrepreneurship. I think one of the examples you also mentioned is the Tony Elumelu Foundation picks, I think, annually 1,000 entrepreneurs. Is that correct? And invest in them?
I believe so, yes. Yeah.
See, you know, seeing that like push and interest and support is really, really exciting. And hopefully that will help to continue to develop the economy in the region, right? So I guess we want to move into the final section of the podcast, which is oftentimes the hardest thing to answer for our participants. It's called three pieces of advice. And I hope you're going to be ready, because imagine yourself coming from an elevator and going down, and you have three questions. You have to answer it very promptly and quickly and fast. Are you ready for this ride?
Let's do it.
Beautiful. Awesome. What one piece of advice would you have to give someone interested in building a career around international business?
That's an interesting one. I would say the most important thing is really curiosity and the ability and interest in building a holistic view of the company you're working with and building a very unbiased view of the markets you're looking at. So, you know, kind of being deeply curious, being really holistic in the way you think about companies and business and opportunities, and then be like really, really curious about markets and cultures and things work, and leave all your prejudice and preconceptions at home, because they're not going to serve you on this journey.
I love that. Just a little call out, holistic localization premium tool. You know, we have actually built a tool to support that, right? So I'm going to call that, you know, out on this podcast. Second question, what one piece of advice do you have business leader expanding a business to new markets?
I think this one is just all about local insights, local empathy, building local teams quickly when you go into new markets. Because the faster you can rely on local leaders driving the growth of the business in a new market, the faster you will be successful.
Cool. Now, the final one and the coolest one that I think of this podcast, think of yourself being that 12-year-old boy that is raised in an Austrian and an Italian home. What one piece of advice would you have for him, you know, before he starts his, you know, career journey in business?
I guess it would just be deeply, 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 deeply curious. Ask a lot of questions. Observe the things around you. Question them. Make sense of them. I think that's just such an important life skill in general, but even more so if you want to go down this career path. I think it's absolutely, absolutely key.
Yeah, so many things start with the right questions, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So Marcelo, thank you so much for spending time with us. There are so many great things that you said, and you're also really great just about characterizing things in really good quotable ways, but you know, talking about how emerging markets, you know, talking about how emerging markets is where the growth is, the importance of immersion and how it helps you understand how trust is built in a market and how that's an important baseline. And then also how development isn't always linear and how we can look to the African continent as a source of innovation and not just an opportunity for market entry. So thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck with continuing to grow Yoko International.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Marcelo.